We're going to go ahead and get started. This is a small group, but we're going to use the microphone so we can record this for a podcast. I want to welcome everyone to Sundays with the Modern. My name is Erin Starr-White. I'm an assistant curator of education here. This afternoon, we're privileged to have artist Tori Tarassi here to speak with us about his interest in the permanent collection. Tori is assistant professor of art at the University of Arlington, and he serves there as the 2D and digital foundations coordinator. He earned his BFA in visual design and English from the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth in 2002, and his MFA from the same university in 2005. He has shown extensively in solo and group exhibitions throughout the country and internationally, and his impressive resume can be found at his website, toritarassi.com. And I have the spelling if anyone would like that. We're going to go ahead and I'll turn it over to Tori so we can get as much as possible from him. Please join me in welcoming Tori Tarassi.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Erin. I'd like to thank the Modern staff for inviting me here. This is a great opportunity. And I would like to talk specifically about three pieces. The first one is here on the bottom floor, the Jenny Holzer. So maybe we could walk over to that space and begin the formal tour over there. Should I shut it off? No. What's the shortest way to get there, do you think? My guess is yes. My guess is yes. Yes, it breaks up on purpose, I think. All right, looks like everybody's here. So the first piece that I want to talk about, hopefully the echo is not too bad for the recording of this, is the Jenny Holzer. This is a new piece to the museum. And just to give very brief background on who she is and the kind of work that she's done, she primarily does text-based works, and she really launched her career doing these printed posters that would be plastered around Manhattan, and she called these truisms, and these came from her graduate studies and her own philosophies, and she would hang these up anonymously. Her name wasn't attached to these pieces, and she would engage a public audience through these truisms. As she evolved as an artist, she started to get into more mass media type pieces and video projections, and this clearly falls in that vein. I think what's interesting about what she has done in her career and what she's doing now is this sort of transition from print or static media to dynamic media or time-based media. The printed pieces that she used to do could only say so much. You only have so much space on a poster. And because they're hung on fences or on the sides of buildings, they're meant to engage with a traveling public. So the messages have to be very short and very brief, maybe 3 to 5, maybe 6 words at most. As she transitions to dynamic media, time-based media, she's able to say more. She's able to explore more text, more content. And in doing so, she started to adopt the texts from other sources. She likes to draw from a lot of declassified government documents and other texts from literary figures worldwide, really. And I find that dynamic to be rather interesting, because what happens in that transition from print to static media is a little unique in Jenny's case. Print media tends to have a name attached to it. It's not anonymous. There's a peer review process before a work goes to print. But what Holter did was she sort of did this guerrilla media fair, where she would just print these pieces, not assign her name, and put it out there to the public. And so we're not really sure who was giving us those truisms early on. Now, when she creates the work, she's a noted artist. She presents a lot of her works in museums and in biennials. And so people know, they're familiar with her work, they know her name. But now she's using dynamic media or digital media. And inherent in digital media, if you look at the internet or mass media, if you look at television commercials, a lot of the work or the author of those works are anonymous. She is certainly not anonymous. So there's sort of an interplay between her celebrity status and the kind of media that she's working with. Now, this particular piece is, I think, rehashing some of the declassified government documents, letters, a variety of texts that were meant to be secretive, meant to be, if maybe personal, but certainly not meant to be shared in the public eye. And here we are now, we have access to this information. And if we actually take the time to read this information, we'd find a lot of it is, maybe sensitive is not the word, very disturbing might be the word, make us feel a little uneasy about some of the things. She talks a lot about war, a lot of the things that are wrong in the world. And she's forcing us to engage with this text. Now, aesthetically, there's a little bit of a contrast going on here. She wants us to engage with this text, but now, as we see, and this is my typography background coming through, she's presenting the letters in a stacked fashion. And that is not conducive to readability. It actually hinders and makes it more difficult to read this text when the letters are stacked one on top of the other. Now, I was here earlier today and before today, and at times these texts do orient themselves the way that we see them in print, and they do become more legible. But I think she's really interested in kind of playing with that dynamic of legibility and illegibility, being able to read something and fully understand something and not completely understanding something. And so there's that dynamic balance that's constantly in play with her digital media work. A lot of her other projections interact with a space, and the text becomes fragmented because of the architecture in the space. So you get a sense of what the text says, but you don't get the full story all the time. So you're kind of left to fill in the gaps. And I think that's really the power of what she does with her text-based works. As far as the text in this particular space, you know, she chooses this blue color, and I just can't help but think, especially when the environment is dark, it has a TV glow quality about it, which is certainly referencing back to that mass media, you know, sensation that we have. And then it also reflects off of the glass and in turn reflects off of the water. And so the piece becomes less about the content of the message or the meaning of the words, and it becomes more about just the overall aesthetics and feel and experience that we have of engaging with the message in a space. And in a lot of ways, the work becomes about that, because legibility is really tough, especially at this angle. The letters are distorted. Sometimes they even move in opposite directions, and it just becomes very difficult to read. So I have to think that she is trying to balance a little bit between the legibility of the media and the illegibility of the mass media. I think that's all I really want to say about this particular piece. So let's go upstairs and take a look at the other two pieces that I want to talk about. And then maybe I'll take questions at the end, so you can ask questions about any of the three pieces at that time. It's like a labyrinth in here, though, at times. Is this the beginning or the end? Oh, perfect. Wait just a few seconds. Fortunately, it looks like we caught the beginning of this piece. This is Yinka Shonabare's Odile and Odette. Actually, we might have caught just the end of it. So this is going to loop back in a few seconds. And this piece was absolutely one of the pieces that I wanted to talk about. The second I saw it, it immediately engaged me. So I think first we need to talk about the title, Odile and Odette. That refers to Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. And as the video continues, we will see exactly how that fits in. But one thing that's kind of interesting is that the video or the projection begins and ends in a very symmetrical way. We get an outside view of this opera house, then we go to this interior of the space. We are placed in the performative realm. We immediately know that this is a performance of sorts. And then it fades away, and then I think it cuts to, I guess, the bulk of the piece. So in Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, it's a story of this heroine, Odette, who is this enchanted princess, and she spends her days as a swan, her nights as a human. And the black swan, or the secondary antagonist, is the daughter of Von Robarth, the evil sorcerer who has sort of transformed his daughter, Odette, into into a doppelganger, into a double of Odette in order to trick Prince Siegfried. So that's just a very basic background of the title of this piece and roughly what we're seeing here. Now, what Shonabari has done, I think, is really clever here, because he's using this play as an analogy for the subject matter that he likes to explore, which is colonialism, specifically British colonialism. And there's certainly some race and ethnicity topics being discussed here. So what we're seeing is we see these two dancers. They are mirroring each other in every way. They are dressed exactly the same. They move exactly the same. Their postures are exactly the same. And so given the title of the piece, we're kind of asked to figure out, well, which one is Odile and which one is Odette? Which one is the good swan? Which one is the bad swan? Or which one is the good person or good entity? Which one is the bad one? And what Shonabari does is he's constantly changing the camera angle on us. So sometimes we are viewing this scene from over the white-skinned dancer's perspective, or over her shoulder, which preferences her, it privileges her, and it makes us feel as though, okay, she is the good one, and the reflection is the bad one. But then the camera will change, and our point of view is now behind, or will soon be behind, the dark-skinned dancer. And in turn, that privileges her, and it makes us more sympathetic to that character, and it makes the white dancer, say it just switched here, it makes the white dancer be the reflection, or the other, the doppelganger, the spirit, the image, the one that's not the true entity. And Shonabari enhances that angle by this giant frame. And it's great because what he does is he probably uses some sort of a black cloth, is my guess, on the exterior of that frame edge. So that when the dancers leave that frame edge, you can no longer see the reflection. So we know that it's not just this frame, it's not an object in a space, but it is in fact supposed to be a mirror with a reflection. Because we don't see on the outside of that frame. So that really helps kind of enforce this notion that this is not two separate people, but it's the reflection of the same person. Now, we're kind of left to fill in the gaps between, obviously, the race, the different races here. And I think that the reflection is so prominent and it's so important that we're kind of left to reflect upon what we're seeing. The reflection is happening not in the piece, but in ourselves. And so we begin to think about some of these issues that Shonabari is bringing forth. I know that he likes to explore grace and beauty as a way to engage with his audience. And there are few things more beautiful than a ballet form, the forms of ballet. The clothing that's worn by these dancers is also symbolic, or refers back to his other work. You can see that the dancers are disappearing here. There's no reflection on the outside of the frame until they go back in. So we know that this is supposed to be a mirror and not just a frame. So the batik used here also ties back to that colonialism in that scene throughout his work. So these colorful patterns, these African-inspired patterns, that are of Dutch design that were... the Dutch tried to sell these patterns in Indonesia, didn't have much success, so then they tried the West African market, and it was sort of readopted by that market. But it went through this process of going to Southeast Asia and going through the Netherlands. And so it's almost as if they are purchasing back their own culture in a lot of ways, their own patterns that they originated. So that's where these dresses and this attire is coming from. But as you watch through this, just be mindful of what the camera is doing. He's using the medium of video to constantly alter our perspectives as to which is the preferenced, or which is the good dancer, which is the reflection, which is the original, which is the duplicate. And so through that, there's that conversation of, well, which is the good and which is the evil? And of course, he's suggesting that really neither is the good, neither is the evil. The differences between these cultures is so minor. We're exactly the same. And I think it's through the love of admiring the beauty of both cultures that we'll be able to find some sort of peace and come to terms with some of the topics that he is he's bringing up. I'm not quite sure how much longer this piece will go. I know it's about a 14-minute loop. But when it concludes, it will go back to the interior of the opera house, and then back to the exterior. So the video does begin as it finishes, to create that seamless loop. Okay, I'm assuming the audio will be edited out anyway, so we can finish this piece. There's probably just a few minutes left. The one other thing I forgot to mention earlier about this is the audio. There's no music, and we are hearing the footsteps and the rotations and the fabric of these dancers. I think that helps us as the audience understand that we're not watching a performance, we're not watching a specific narrative, we're watching more of a metaphor. We're watching an analogy for something else. So it's not like a movie, right? It's not like a ballet where this is going to be accompanied by music. It's stripped down. It's bare and it's naked in terms of the audio. So it places it in a very different context than that of a performance. It really sort of elevates it to a level of fine art, of something to contemplate. All right, I'm guessing I probably spoke through the loop, so this could be 10 minutes before it goes back to the beginning. Let's go talk about the last piece, the Hirakisawas, and then I'll open it up for questions. So the next piece I want to talk about is just right around the corner. Thank you. All right, now, Haraki Sawa's dwelling. I know that this is almost at the end of the video, but this is also set to a loop, so this is going to come back to the beginning in just a moment. I think we can draw a lot of meaning from the title of this piece, Dwelling. So if we think about what that word means, and in all likelihood how he intended us to take that title, we get two obvious interpretations. The first kind of dwelling is a place of living, right? A house, an apartment, just some place where one resides. The other meaning of dwelling is more of a mental dwelling, something that you think about constantly, something that harps on your mind for long periods of time. And so what Sawa is doing is he's combining the double entendre of that meaning and is sort of merging it into one visual experience. This is his apartment. This is where he lives. Or it could stand for anyone's apartment or anyone's place of residence. But then you also have the dwelling of this mental capacity, something that you think about for a long period of time. You really engage with it on a very deep level. And so what we see in this is this relatively barren apartment. There's no pictures hanging on the wall. There's no personalized objects, clothes, sculptures. It really could stand for anyone's apartment or anyone's house. The only thing that we really notice are these miniaturized flying airplanes everywhere. Very humorous. And he kind of just leaves us with those two thoughts. And we are left to kind of put together our own story here. Now, speaking from my own experiences, I have been in these kinds of apartments. I have been in these situations where the environment is not especially engaging. There's not a lot to listen to. There's not a lot to look at. You've got nothing but time on your hands. And so you just sit there. Could be for hours on end. I mean, you just sit there and just do nothing. But there's a real power in that act of doing nothing. And what happens is after a while, your mind is going to start to assign meaning. It's going to become very inventive, very creative, and very engaged. So, I mean, even Da Vinci has experienced this, John Cage. There's a countless list of artists who talk about the power of just doing nothing for a while, of just sitting there and staring into the emptiness. What will happen is the seemingly empty environment will start to, you'll start to notice things that you didn't notice before. You'll notice the motor of the refrigeration unit. You'll notice birds chirping off in the distance. You'll notice the sound of the heater kicking in. And visually, you'll also have a lot of the same experiences. You'll notice how the crack in the wall looks like an aerial view of rivers. You'll notice how the water stain on the ceiling starts to look like the profile of people. You'll start to take some of the marks on the wall, some of the architecture on the wall, and you build landscapes in your mind. And so I believe that that's what Sawa is kind of exploring in this piece, is sort of the power of the imagination and the ability of tapping into that childlike state of not fully understanding what's going on because you don't recognize things, and just letting the imagination take you where it goes. So here's the end of the piece where we see a real airplane flying in a real space. So he's kind of bringing it full circle. This will loop back to the beginning in just a few moments. And so the beginning starts with an exterior shot of his apartment. He then brings us with a few seconds shot of a stairwell where he's bringing us into the space. And again, there's nothing especially unique about this particular shot. This could be anybody's apartment. This could be anywhere in the world. There's nothing unique or special about this either. This could be, it's sort of every man's place of dwelling. It's really not until the airplanes come up that we really start to engage with it. The other device that he uses is one of scale. Obviously, these large airplanes don't belong in this space. They don't belong on a table. They don't belong on a bed. They don't belong in the kitchen. And so again, he's tapping into that childlike notion. And for some reason, scale, or the variety, changing, playing with scale, seems to be something inherent when you were talking about children's imaginations. And we see this in literature. We see this in Jack and the Beanstalk, this playing with scale. We see this in Alice in Wonderland, playing of scale. And there's something really powerful about playing with scale in regards to how it relates to children, because for children, everything is out of scale. All of the objects that we have in our house, that we have in our lives, cars, chairs, pencils, everything is designed for the adult, for someone between the height of, you know, 5 feet and 6 feet. It's not designed for somebody who's only 2.5 feet tall. So I think just by playing with scale, we're immediately brought into this realm of childlike experiences and this whimsical imagination state. And you know, I don't believe that these airplanes represent anything to do with immigration. I see that as a possible interpretation, but I don't believe that that's what the artist's intention was. I think this is strictly about whimsy and more flight of imagination, not flight of your personal self. Also, like in the Shanabari piece, sound plays a very important role here. He's done the same thing. He has stripped this video of sound with just a few exceptions. Periodically, we hear the roar of an airplane. And that's the only sound element in here. We don't hear no background music, no voices, no car horns on the outside of the apartment. And so again, he's sort of telling us this is not a definitive narrative, but it's something to be contemplated about, something to be thought about. And the audio is influencing us to feel that, or to interpret the work in that way. So I suppose I would like to hear some of your comments, or I'll do my best to answer any questions that you might have about any of these three pieces that we talked about. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep, and I don't know how much this is picking up, so I'll repeat that question. So the question came up was, how does the size of the projection on the wall maybe influence our interpretation of it or our experience based on, say, seeing something projected large or something small, like on a television? My response to that would be, not the bigger is better response, but I think it's more about creating an immersive environment. You know, and I kind of alluded to the power of television when I was talking about the Holzer, you know, that warm blue glow that mesmerizes you. So even at a very small scale, television, video, film has an extremely powerful hold over us, over our gaze. But when the projection or the image is larger, it completely encompasses us. And so, you know, this is the power of movies. This is really the power of virtual reality. I mean, it is about creating an immersive environment. And I think what happens, especially in this particular piece, is that we are immediately thrown back into our apartments, our houses, places that we have experienced. We're no longer in the museum, but we are here. Because we're able to kind of block out everything else because it's so large, it takes up our entire field of vision. So I think that that's the power, or that's the influence that having a large projection has versus something that's on a smaller television screen. Are there other questions or comments about any of the pieces? Yes. The Shanabari, I think that's how we say it. Yeah.
Because you mentioned that he starts outside the building and ends inside the building. Mm-hmm. And the only other movie I've seen did essentially the same thing. So does he do that in all of his films? Or do you know?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, I don't know if he does that in a lot of his films, but we know he does it in two of them now. I think he in a lot of ways is approaching that for the exact opposite reasons that Sauer is doing it. He wants us to recognize that there is a real world, that this story that we're about to see or experience has connections to the outside world. So that as we think about what we're seeing, or as we are internalizing or interpreting, in this case, the dancers, we start to think, well, how does this connect to the world that I live in? It's not just a self-contained video that just takes place in this static black environment with these two dancers, but we see the connection between that analogy, the opera house, the outside architecture with cars going by, and a city landscape. So I think it helps make the transition that this, what he's talking about in this black environment with the two dancers, projects to or connects to the real world, and that we really need to think about what he's saying in his artwork, but think about it in terms of real world experiences. How does it relate to the world that we live in? That would be my interpretation of that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that all of the intro is snapshots. Mm-hmm. It's not a video, not movie. Only the movie started with the dance. Was that, you think there's a...
You know, I didn't notice that. I would have to go back and see. I'm curious if it's actually snapshots or if it's still video. It still might be video, but it's just not moving. There's nothing...
But it's treated as a separate image.
Right. Right. Yeah, again, I don't remember if there was slight panning or if it was strictly static with the fade. But those images did fade in and fade out, which is a kind of motion. I mean, it is time-based media. It does take time for it to fade in and fade out. It wasn't just an instant snapshot. I think by doing something like that, just, you know, being a maker myself, a media artist myself, I think he's kind of just easing us into the piece. And so that when we do see motion, we become heightened. That would be my guess.
And also on this piece, mm-hmm. The technology, the appearance of the technology seems to be almost a fashion. So over time, it's very
fast. Well, I think you're talking about the integration of the airplanes to the... So the question again for the recording here was that the technology looks a little old-fashioned, maybe a little primitive compared to, say, the Lord of the Rings movies that we see. Well, I think there's a few things going on. He did this piece while he was in graduate school, so he may have been learning the technology as he was doing it. But I think more importantly than that is he wants this to look a little primitive, a little basic, because I do believe it's about imagination. It's not about tricking us into thinking these airplanes are miniaturized and they're flying inside this interior space. It's about how a child might see this, or how our minds, working like a child's mind, might see something that looks unreal. It's about being unreal. He's not trying to make it realistic. He wants it to look fantastic. So I do think I would need to see some of his more recent pieces. But I'm guessing he's sticking with this aesthetic of trying to make it look a little hokey, a little fake, just a little bit. I mean, there's still a great amount of technical prowess going on here. I mean, the drop shadows, or the shadows being cast by the planes, is actually not terribly easy to do, technically speaking, as far as animation or video editing goes. So he is showing off some of his skills. And this airplane right here actually just turns slightly the angle. You know, this isn't a 3D model. He must have done that with a series of either static images or video images from different angles. And in the editing of the video, just put them very, very quickly right after another to create the illusion of turning. So I think he's kind of walking that line of having control of his tools, but allowing it to just sort of be simplified. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, there's a connection between this and the Holzer, and it's that sense of desensitizing. We see so much gore, and we read so much bad things in the mass media. That's sort of what Holzer is engaging us in the museum setting with. Perhaps people of today, especially children of today, it doesn't seem... They're not impressed by this. That sense of magic has been lost because a lot of people have these kinds of skills. We see this visual magic everywhere. I mean, even just television commercials, web banners. I mean, the simplest of places. Digital media has really desensitized our visual sensibilities. We're not impressed as easily anymore. Well, it is, but, you know, I think by simplifying the process, we become a little bit more contemplative about it. We don't just consume the images, but we just think about it. There's less elements to think about. Limited audio, no color, limited things that are moving, nothing else in the apartment to see. So we're just left with those three or four things to think about. We're not overwhelmed by all this fancy visual trickery. Yes. Yes.
Was the scion 2 feet or 4 feet? I mean, they're 4 feet. Mm-hmm. So was the scion and that scion made of 2 feet?
That's a very interesting question. The question was the audio in the Shanabari piece, is it 2 feet or 4 feet that we're hearing? It's a little ambiguous, which is all to the better. The space in which that was shot has a clear echo. The echo serves as a really nice metaphor for the visual echo, the reflection that we're seeing. We have reflection, we have echo. So we're not sure. And I think that's the power of it. We don't know if we're hearing or if we're seeing, in the case of hearing, if we're hearing the 2 feet pounding on the floor, or are we hearing 4 feet, or are we hearing 2 feet and then the echo of those 2 feet creating 4 feet? I believe so. I mean, I think that the sound and the visuals and that ambiguity between, is it only one thing that we're seeing and that one thing's reflection, or is it two things that are simultaneously working together? We just never know. We never really know. And that's the beauty of the piece, really, is that we don't know and we're left to ask those kinds of questions. Noel. Well, if that's it, I'd like to thank you, and I'll certainly be available to talk with you if you care to, but thank you very much.